Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, preparing to receive Pope Benedict for the traditional Papal Ash Wednesday procession on Rome's Aventine Hill, marking the beginning of Lent, and imagining a world without fish, a frightening prospect that may not be so imaginary after all. The Vatican sounds the alarm, but is anyone listening? Residents and religious on Rome's Aventine Hill are putting the final touches to preparations for Pope Benedict's pilgrimage across the Tiber River Wednesday. Pope Benedict will officially begin the Lenten period with a traditional Ash Wednesday procession and Mass in the afternoon. The Pope is expected to go to the Church of Sant'Anselmo, or St. Anselm, where he will join the Benedictine friars and other religious for a moment of prayer. Afterwards, the Holy Father and his entourage of cardinals and bishops will make their way just down the street to the Basilica of St. Sabina to celebrate the liturgy and for the blessing and imposition of ashes on the faithful. Well, the Basilica of Santa Sabina, as it's known here, is nestled amidst orange groves and gardens hidden behind old stone walls. It is one of the oldest churches in Rome, dating as far back as about the year 422. Santa Sabina became one of the so-called station churches where Rome's early Christian community would gather for processions and liturgies in Lent and other periods holy to the Christian calendar. Sant'Anselmo, just down the street, was, and in this case still is, a collect church where the faithful would assemble before proceeding to the station church of Santa Sabina. The Priory of the Dominican Order is attached to Santa Sabina, and all the friars and religious there are getting ready for the Holy Father's arrival. I asked the Order's Procurator General, Father Robert Ombras, how he remembers the last few Ash Wednesday papal liturgies.
Well, the first year I was here, I think Pope John Paul was unwell, so he couldn't come. So my memories are of Pope Benedict, his two visits, and I would say it's the time when you really come to understand that, among other things, the Pope is the Bishop of Rome, and so he takes care and interest in being in churches in his diocese.
And this is one of the oldest churches in Rome, isn't it? And it's quite austere. It's not, you know, incredibly ornate or decorated. So it must be quite, thought-provoking to be in this church at this time with the Pope, the leader of the Universal Church, and the Bishop of Rome.
Yes, I think you're right. I think for many people, among the different churches in Rome, Santa Sabina could well be their favourite. And if you ask why, they usually say something like, it's simple, it's austere, it's full of light, a play of light on marble. There are Baroque side chapels, but so much of Rome is Baroque, so much of southern Italy, that I think after a while perhaps the eyes need rest from detail and colour, and I think they find the play of light, the volume, the shape of the church, prayerful in itself, or an invitation to prayer. And when the Pope comes, then of course we're taken back. Well, this church has been here over 1,500 years, and so people have been going to Mass, praying in our church, for 1,500 years, and of course the papacy has been in Rome longer, and that is a way of just seeing the antiquity, if you like, going back to the origins, in such an ancient basilica with such an ancient office as that of the Pope.
Who was Saint Sabina? And is she? I know she's buried here. And also, of course, this church is extremely important for the Dominican order. Tell me how, how do you see these two figures also related to this great moment, this great tradition of the Pope coming here?
The Pope tends to have red shoes or red slippers, which is traditionally thought to be connected to martyrdom. It's one of the symbolisms of his office. And Santa Sabina was an early martyr here in Rome. She was a wealthy woman, a pagan, and she had a slave woman, I think from Syria, who became a Christian and is thought converted her mistress, Sabina. And they were came under suspicion. They were interrogated and warned. And this slave was executed first. Sabina, perhaps because she was powerful, she was rich, was given warnings, but she persisted in being a Christian. So she was martyred. And a cult grew up here on the Aventine to her. And then in the 5th century, more or less when the station masses started, in the 5th century, a priest from Illyria, what we now call Croatia, I suppose, built Santa Sabina. This is why the square outside Santa Sabina is called Piazza Pietro di Illyria, because the priest who paid for the church, and there's a mosaic inside saying how he built it, paid for it. So the cult Sabina was strengthened by building this basilica, and I imagine the link with the papacy is partly, as I said, because of the antiquity, the age of both institutions, the papacy and Santa Sabina, although obviously the papacy came first. But I imagine it's to do with martyrdom and witnessing. And of course, St. Peter's is built over the tomb of St. Peter, and there are the two apostles, Peter and Paul, martyred in Rome. And I think so the martyrdom would be the key linking the witnessing of the papacy and the witness of this particular Christian woman.
And how did the Dominicans come to Santa Sabina?
Well, when St. Dominic, in the 13th century, early in the 13th century, was looking for a site for his friars and the church in Rome, he asked the Pope whether he could have a church with space to build a priory, and the Pope gave us Santa Sabina, which had been a basilica, of course, already for 700 years, when we came 800 years ago, and gradually we built a priory, which we're now sitting in, little by little, since the early 13th century. And the priests who served the church, basilica, eventually left, and we have both the church and the priory.
And was St. Dominic buried here as well?
No, St. Dominic was on the move all his life, as all good friars should be, and he died and is buried in Bologna, in our church at Bologna. But he lived here, and we know the room he had, and it's now turned into a little chapel. But we know where he lived, in Santa Sabina.
Now, every Ash Wednesday, Pope Benedict started this practice up. Pope John Paul, I think in the last few years of his life, he wasn't able, perhaps, to do this. He goes on a procession from the Collect Church of Sant'Anselmo, just down the road here on the Aventine Hill, and then they proceed up here to Santa Sabina. Tell us a little bit more about what are Collect Churches and Station Churches.
Yes, as far as we know, he's due to come. We hope he's pleased to come. We're certainly pleased, as well as honoured, to receive him, to begin our Lent. The practice you mentioned is very ancient in Rome. It probably dates from about the time, or possibly even before, Santa Sabina was built as a church. So we're talking about 1,500 years ago. And on various days of the year, and eventually on in Lent, the practice grew up of station days or station masses. Now, station, from the Latin statio, means a stop, rather like a railway station. That means where the train stops. So a station church is where the procession ends and where the liturgy is then celebrated. Because processions are so important in Christian life, the custom grew up of having a procession from somewhere to the station church for the station mass, including Ash Wednesday. And so people gathered, hence collecta, people collected, gathered in one church. Here on the Aventine, in the Middle Ages, it was St. Anastasia, and as you say, it's now become St. Anselmo, the Benedictine house. And we now process The Pope arrives at St. Anselmo, the brief prayers, and then we process the Benedictine monks on one side and the Dominican friars on the other, with the cardinals, bishops, the Pope at the rear, and we come to Santa Sabina. And I think processions matter because they're both a public witness, reminding people, martyrdom means witness. So yet again, the theme of witnessing to God, to Christ in public, symbolized in the procession. And it also has a penitential element, which fits in well with Ash Wednesday. And of course, a procession is a mini pilgrimage, which is another marvelous Christian experience to participate in.
You know, we said there were about 40 station churches. I imagine then there were about 40 collect churches. And it's a tradition that dates back from the very earliest times of Christianity. Is that right, here in Rome?
Yes, yes. The days have varied. The churches have varied. I think that the tradition, the custom, is well attested.
But so they would have gone during the 40 days of Lent to each one of these churches, is that right?
Either the Pope or someone representing him, I think, would have participated in each station church for the station mass. And the faithful from that church or area would have gathered. Of course, especially in Italy, people are very loyal to their locality. And so it would have, each little community in Rome would have taken great pride in being involved so directly with liturgy of the Pope outside the Lateran, which is the Pope's cathedral, or St. Peter's.
But everything you're saying is in the past tense. It's a shame that this tradition hasn't continued, though.
Yes, it has continued in some ways, but perhaps not as strongly as it might. Pope John Paul II, we all remember how much he cared for processions, pilgrimages, public gatherings of Christians. And I think perhaps after some uncertainties in the past, the desire to be more anonymous as Christians, to blend in more with all our neighbours, perhaps gradually a theme of witnessing in charity, discreetly, without arrogance, I think might come back.
Father Robert Ombres is the Procurator General of the Dominican Order. Phrase, they're not biting today? Well, that's something you might be hearing all too frequently from holiday and professional fishermen from now on. Think about it. No seafood pasta, no fillet of sole, tuna, or mackerel on the dinner table, no sushi for lunch. What would the world be like without such a staple food as fish? Well, Vatican experts in the Apostleship of the Sea are sounding the alarm. Despite the vast amounts of seas and oceans covering the surface of the earth, we're consuming so much seafood that soon there won't be any fish left.
World fish stock is at its lowest. For the first time in the world history, it is feared that fish will disappear from the seas.
Archbishop Agostino Marchetto is Secretary of the Pontifical Council for the Care of Migrants and Itinerants, which is responsible for the Church's Apostleship of the Sea. He says the fishing industry is exploiting stocks without allowing them time to replenish. I found his statement shocking. Are we really that close to having the fish disappear from the seas? I asked the regional director of the Apostleship of the Sea for Oceania, Ted Richardson, why is no one talking about this disaster waiting to happen?
I just don't know. I often think to myself, do people really care? When I talk to people, they do. But they're just not aware of it.
It's shocking. Shocking.
Yeah.
We may not have fish in a few years in the world's seas.
Yeah. I'll just give you some idea, we are consuming per person. This is every person in the world consumes on average 16.6 kilos of seafood. Doesn't matter whether you're rich or the poorest. 16.6 kilos of seafood. That's 106 million tons of seafood is being consumed. And we're taking 94 million tons of oil out of the seafood. For oil for cooking and these sorts of things. So it's a massive amount of sea stock that is being taken away. And
we think is this equally distributed throughout the world in various regions? Or
the richer have more. The richer countries have more. I was with a fellow the other day, and he ordered a dish of calamari. It was 26 euro for a dish of calamari.
Which is about $40, $35.
Yeah. And I thought, if that one piece of calamari is worth that much, how much money is being made from a ship that is fishing thousands of calamari per minute, just hooking them and throwing them into tanks? And who's making all this money?
Well, I would doubt that it's the fishermen who are making all that money.
Oh, they're definitely not making that money. So where are the profits going? Who's using these profits, and why are they not putting them back into the resource? Why are they not working out methods of fish farming, of preserving the fish stocks worldwide? We shouldn't be getting to this stage. We are getting there. We're almost there, that we will run out of fish in the next decade if we don't do something over the next 10 years.
Is that what they're saying? Within 10 years?
Within 10 years, we will not be able to buy fish. It will be so expensive, we won't be able to afford it. It'll be $100 a plate for a meal. And or 100 euro for a meal for fish food.
What about countries like, forgive me, but Japan, that fish is such an integral part of their meals?
To put it mildly, they're in a lot of trouble. A country that survives on fish, that relies on fish, that has fish on just about every meal that they have, are going to have to find a new diet because it's not going to be there. We cannot sustain the overfishing that is taking place.
Explain to me how we're overfishing.
Well, it's very simple. We have too many boats chasing too few fish. We have the technology now to find a fish. If it's hiding behind a rock, we can find it and catch it. And
how do we do that?
We've got all these instruments that tell us exactly.
Radar,
sonar, echo-sounding devices. We can find the fish. It's not a big problem. The people that are missing out are the small fishing communities, small island nations. Now, the big fishing companies are stretched out so much that they think, okay, now we start hitting all these small nations and fishing out their lagoons because it's the only place we can find fish anymore. There's a market demand for fish, and they're trying to satisfy the market, but in doing so, the fish population's dying. We're disappearing. I know I used to be able to go and stand on the beach, and I would catch a few fish and come home and have breakfast. I can stand there all day now and not catch a fish, not even get a nibble on my line. And that's in a country like Australia. And you go, where are the fish gone? What's happened to them? We can't keep taking and taking and taking and not putting back. We have to put back. We have to close off areas and make these areas marine reserves for future populations and say, we won't fish there. We can't fish there. We have to police it and stop people from fishing there to say, this is the nursery. This is the breeding ground for our future generations.
But you said to me earlier that it's not easy. It takes a long time. Fish lay a lot of eggs. How long does it take a fish to grow to the size of a dinner plate?
3 to 5 years from a hatchling.
That long?
Yeah. So we can...
And not all those fish survive?
No, because they're consumed by other fish. If you have turtles hatching, half a dozen turtles out of hundreds of eggs will survive to maturity. The rest will die, will be eaten up by other animals, will be consumed by birds. Even the fish that we catch in the fishing nets, they put back into the sea the ones they don't want. Have you ever seen how many birds follow a ship, a fishing ship, and how many of those birds just pluck those fish straight out of the sea? It's an easy feeding for them. So not much goes back into the sea that is of any use because the birds have picked up anything that you've thrown back. So everything you've caught in your nets is gone. And this is the things that we have to change. We have to develop nets that actually only catch the food that we want. That they are bigger fish or smaller fish are fed through the nets and out the other side, so they stay in the bottom of the sea. They don't come to the surface. And deep sea fishing is another one. We can, the deepest of sea, we can hunt those fish down and we can catch them. if we grow a farm of corn and we plant the seed, we grow the corn and we harvest the corn. As soon as that harvest, we mow it down, we turn the soil over, we plant a new crop. Every year we can get a crop out of that farm 2-3 times a year. The seed, we can get one crop every 5 years. So once you harvest that seed, it's 5 years before we can go back and harvest that seed again because the fish stocks have gone. They're not going to be there, and we can't just keep going back and taking it. It's a bit smaller this year, but we'll take it. It's a bit smaller next year, we'll take it, till there's nothing left.
So, but is the problem here then the big fishing trawlers, the big industries?
The big industries are the biggest problem that we have, because they are the ones who can go out and systematically take the majority of them, even more than majority, nearly all of the fish. They are taking the food from the small, sustainable communities that live off the edges of the island nations and things like this. They will take anything they can, as much of it as they can. And they do it in a fashion that is a don't care. We don't care about tomorrow.
But today. Are there international quotas for fish?
No. The quotas for ships and numbers of fish, no. They can fish year round.
What do you see as a resolution to this problem? You were mentioning the creation of perhaps of marine reserves where no fishing would be allowed for a certain number of years to replenish the stock of fish in a certain area.
Yeah.
But there are problems with that, you said.
There are problems with marine reserves and whether you have the ability to be able to police them, to ensure that marine reserve is protected and that no one is going to fish there.
But I mean, would you
see... If people do fish there, that you can catch them and you can fine them tens of thousands of dollars for doing so.
I mean, do you envision, for example, off Australia's coast, one big, huge marine reserve, off Japan's coast, another big reserve? Each individual country would be responsible for its own marine reserves to help repopulate the fish?
Yeah, you don't need big reserves. What you need is fish tend to migrate to what we call nurseries, where they will come in their thousands and they will lay their eggs, and that's their grounds. It's like a turtle will always come back to the same beach to lay its eggs. A fish will come back to a certain area where they spawn, and that's their spawning ground. Those spawning grounds are reserves. They have to be reserved. They have to be protected to give those fish the best possible chance to become future stocks for the rest of us. You can't build a fence and say we're going to keep these fish in here. They will swim through that fence or out beyond those boundaries and then they get caught. That's just a natural part of the environment. But you're giving them a chance. You're giving them a place to start. You're not in there catching the big fish who swim upstream to spawn. Trout and all these sort of things will swim upstream, spawn and die. But if you stop them going up, just 1 year, we stop them going up there and we catch them all because they're big and they're fat and they're healthy and they've got good rows. We've killed a lot. They're gone. There's no future generations. And these are the things that we have to be careful of, that we're not taking those fish. And we don't have any reserves. We have marine parks for coral and these sorts of things. And they're wonderful, but they don't do anything for the fish spawning grounds. We know where the fish spawning grounds are, so do the fishermen. And the fishermen go there and say, thank you, we'll grab what we can out of there and get out before anyone sees us. We need to be able to police it. We need to be able to control it. That's the first thing. The second thing is we need to be able to license credible fishing vessels. You can't buy a net, you can't buy bait, you can't get fuel for your boat unless you are an accredited producer, unless you have the right mindset and right aspects to be a good producer and somebody who's going to preserve the future for stock for everybody else.
Maybe, again, that's something that's very difficult to police.
It would be up to each government to do something, to put something in place to say, we have minimum standards, and these are our minimum standards that apply. Unless you fit these minimum standards, you can't get a license. But if you do have a license, then you have a license for life. You have a license you can pass on to your children, their generation, and so on. You have a license that if you look after this reserve that you have that says this is your 10-acre block that you can fish in. It might be a 1,000-acre block. Who knows how big the fishing thing is. But you can say this is the area that is yours. That's your piece of property. That's your fishing area where you can fish in, your license to fish in that area. You can sell that. You look after it, maintain it, keep it. You can sell it to another cooperative, or you can sell it to another person, or you can keep it as an inheritance to pass on to your children or whatever. But if you don't look after it, you lose it. you get your license taken away from you. You don't have any future access to that. You can't buy anything. You can't buy a fishing net. You can't buy a hook for a longline vessel. You can't do anything. So if you can stop the supply of the equipment, you stop the fishing.
But what happens if someone comes in on my plot, my undersea plot, where I'm doing all my fishing and I have a license for this area? What happens if somebody else comes along?
You would have to put in mechanisms to protect your plot, as we call it. If somebody is fishing in your backyard, to me it's just like trespassing. They would lose their license, they'd lose their equipment. You just can't do that. If somebody comes into your yard and takes your property, that's burglary, it's stealing. You would have the same laws apply.
Okay, but here all the huge fishing industry trawlers would be the ones to stand to benefit because they have more money. They would be able to buy huge, huge plots.
Your government would have to limit the amount of area that they would be able to take. You would stop those huge, big conglomerates. They would have to buy their neighbours' yards and buy the whole street, as it were, of blocks.
Well, a lot of poor little fishermen in Sri Lanka or somewhere might be willing to do that, not looking.
But again, they would have to have government approval to do it. You can't just sell it. You would have to get the government's permission to be able to sell that to this big conglomerate. And the governments, again, would have to look at their reserve and again look at their fishing record and say, how do we, if we let this sale go through, how do we then protect future stocks? Will that big conglomerate take everything and we're back to where we were? The government would have to police the controls on who owns, who sells, who buys. And it's the only real way that we're going to keep our sea reserves. If I have a home that I'm proud of and I look after it and maintain it and keep it in good condition, it increases in value. If I have a home that I don't care about, I don't look after, I let it fall into rack and ruin, I never paint it, never care for it, let the grass grow 10 feet tall, it's worth nothing. It's not worth anything to me. So it's in my best interest to look after my backyard. It's in my best interest to look after my inheritance for my future generations and children. And I think that's the way we have to look at our marine environment. How are we going to look after it and preserve it for our future generations? We have to find mechanisms. All the ones that I've spoken about, I think we can improve on. Whether in reality governments do something is a job for us in the future. We have to push our governments to do something now. We don't have the time left to wait. We must do it now. It has to happen for the next 10 years, or we're going to be paying $100 a meal.
$100 a meal if we're lucky enough to find any fish. Thanks there to Australia-based Regional Director of the Apostleship of the Sea for Oceania, Ted Richardson. Well, that brings today's program to a close. I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for joining me for the last half hour. Tune in again tomorrow at the same time and on this same channel for the next English feature program, or you can hear us at any time of the day or night by clicking on our website. That's vaticanradio.org. Just look for the English service. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email. We appreciate snail mail, too. Just send us a note to The English Service at Vatican Radio, Piazza Pia 3, Vatican City, 00120. Again, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.